Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Latin American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Candela Marini, your host, and today we're talking to Luis Valerio Trindade about his book, No Laughing Matter, Race, Joking, and Resistance in Brazilian Social Media, published by Vernon Press this past year, 2020. Luis Valerio Trindade holds a PhD in sociology from the University of Southampton, where he investigated the phenomenon of racist hate speech on social media, and particularly against Black Brazilian women. In this research, he found that most of the racist hate speech has been conveyed through disparagement humor, which is, of course, the subject of his book and what we're going to talk about today. So what's the impact of this kind of race joking in Brazilian society? So welcome, Luis Valerio, and thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thank you. Thank you, Mandela. Thank you very much for the invitation.
No, thank you. And so I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself and how you started with the research for this book.
Okay. So I'm a Brazilian national. So I was born in São Paulo. And I've been researching the social condition of a Black Brazilian since 2006. And from 2006 to 2008, I developed master research regarding the social representation of Black Brazilians on printed advertisements. And after that, a few years after that, then I went for my PhD in sociology, and then I expanded my research interest. And because it called my attention, the fact that social media has become very popular in Brazil, and also that many people were using this platform to convey racist ideologies. So that caught my attention. So that has triggered my interest in investigating this social phenomenon.
Right. And maybe before we dive into that, and I know this is a very large question, but could you offer us a general idea of the history and formation of race relations in Brazilian society? What are some of the key historical developments that people should take into account when thinking about race dynamics in Brazil?
Yes, in fact, one of my concerns, of my focus when I developed this research and the book in particular, was to provide the reader with contextual perspective regarding the construction of racial relations in Brazil, because not necessarily everyone that read the book would be familiar with those contexts. So I started developing a contextual explanation from the late 19th century upwards, because if you pay attention in nowadays racial relations and also the discourse regarding race and racism in Brazil, if you don't review those colonial legacies, it becomes difficult to understand their origin and their motivations. So I have researched review, better speaking, the legacies, the colonial legacies in building those relations. So just to be more specific, I address, for example, the modernity or the project of modernity that the Brazilian elite has built on the beginning of the 20th century that was mirrored in the Eurocentric models of modernity. And what does it mean? It means a model focused on whitening ideology, considering whitening as the ultimate symbol of humanity, modernity, progress, and all sorts of positive attributes. And in contrast, all the negative attributes, they started to be associated with blackness. So that creates the foundation of the Brazilian racial relations, and it's manifested up to the present time.
So what were some of these strategies to foster this kind of whitening project?
Yes. Well, there is one emblematic study that was published in 1911. Yes, 1911 in London by a Brazilian scholar of that time that praised whitening. And he believed that within one century or three generations from that time, Brazil would become a white-only country. And how he constructed this belief, this understanding. Because on the turn of the 19th to the 20th century, when Brazil abolished slavery, it has started a process of fostering of immigration of white Europeans, workers to work in the farms. And the Brazilian elite at that time believed that this immigration of white Europeans mixing with the predominantly black and miscegenated population, as time went by, they would become only white. So that created the foundation of the whitening ideology and praising whitening as the ultimate symbol of modernity and progress. So that was, you know, the strategy implemented by the Brazilian elite on the beginning of the 20th century.
But then you also distinguish other, let's call it stages, in how race is conceived in Brazil. And very famously, Brazil has this myth of racial democracy. Could you talk a little bit about that, when it started to develop?
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. So this was this whitening ideology that dominated the thoughts of the Brazilian elite and some inflation authors in the beginning of the 20th century, up to the mid-20s, 1920s. And then in the mid of 1930s, emerged the idea of racial democracy. So in the first couple of decades of the 20th century, the elite believed that blackness and mestizage, they were degenerating the Brazilian population. However, in the early 1930s, emerged the idea that, in fact, the Brazilian miscegenated population represented not a problem, but indeed a differentiation comparing to other nations. So in this time, we had the publication of an influential book called The Masters and the Slaves by Gilberto Freire. And this book contributed to the development of the idea that the Brazilian slavery regime was not as, severe as it has been in the U.S. And in fact, they believe that the Brazilian slavery regime was much kinder. and that in fact there was a harmonious combination of black population, European, and indigenous. And that created the idea of a harmonious racial relation. And that was the backbone of the so-called racial democracy.
Yes, and you mentioned how even, I guess, before Freire, these ideas were encouraged when you explained, for instance, how right after the abolition of slavery, the whole archive around slavery was burned in a kind of gesture to say, maybe to deny it or to deny its consequences in a post-slaved society. And even how it was certain phrases in the national hymn of and in the national anthem of Brazil kind of denied also the consequences and the legacies of slavery. When was this myth of racial democracy challenged? When did it start to be challenged?
Yeah, it took a while. In fact, you said rightly, the Brazilian elite. In their quest to develop, you know, the Brazilian, or not to develop, but to put Brazil into the modern era. So the legacy of the slavery was something that they didn't want to face. So there was a conscious denial of three and a half centuries of slavery regime. In this move of denying the legacy, so there was this historical event where Rui Barbosa, that was a minister at that time in 1890, he demanded that a document that was in the archive related to the ownership of slaves, they should be burned because he believed that we were entering a new era and that mark should be deleted from history. So that's why he demanded that those documents should be burned. And evolving from there, so the myth of racial democracy started to be challenged only in the 1960s. So from that moment onwards, that the myth of racial democracy started to be challenged. Because it was some scholars, they brought to the surface the fact that blacks and whites in Brazil, they had very different starting points. What does it mean? It means that the opportunities for upward social mobilities, they were completely unequal. So there was a strong racial problem in Brazil. And that racial democracy was trying to disguise that, you know. So they were fostering the idea, the defenders of racial democracy, they defend the idea of meritocracy. But meritocracy is valid when the starting point for different racial and social groups is the same. When the starting point, they are very different, then it's not meritocracy, it's privilege.
At the beginning of the book, you include a very interesting study. Well, it's actually, I think, the census data from the 1970s, where people self-identified racially in a lot of different ways. I don't know how many different categories they use. And I cannot imagine a similar kind of response in a place like the US, for instance. Could you talk about a little bit more about that data and how people think of race today and how people self-identify in regards to race in Brazil?
Yes, absolutely. What happens is that, as I said a moment ago, so this process of building the modern Brazil, the central pillar of this modern Brazil was and continues to be whitening ideology, meaning that all positive attributes are related to whiteness. So beauty standard, intellectuality, progress, and so forth. And in contrast, a series of negative attributes, laziness, backwardness, ugliness, and so forth, they are associated with blackness. So in the 1970s, the census, they used to be self-declaration. So people, they had the possibility to declare to which racial group they belong to, white, black, or in between, you know, miscegenated and different terminologies. But since this belief in whitening as the ultimate symbol of modernity and so forth, it's so deeply linked, so deeply, present in the collective mindset that the people say, okay, I might not be exactly white, but I don't want to be associated with blackness. So they created 120 different terminologies to classify themselves as miscegenated. So they didn't say simply, I'm miscegenated. They created so different terminologies, but in a sense, those creative terminologies, intermediary terminologies, they had, and they still have, the objective to distance themselves from blackness, because there are so many negative attributes associated with blackness, and get as close as possible to the whiteness, because that's the symbol, ultimate symbol of modernity, beauty, and so forth.
Yeah, incredible. So what's the other side of this whitening ideology? How have Black Brazilians organize themselves and resist this kind of narratives and power dynamics?
There has been several initiatives, to resistance to racism in Brazil. That's not new. That comes since from the colonial times. But more recently, let's say in the contemporary Brazil, those initiatives, they have moved mainly to the online environment. Of course, there is still the organized Black movement, a lot of initiatives. But digital technologies has enabled the Black people to convey a different perspective, a different perception of Blackness, to value more Blackness as a to challenge all those negative attributes that are so entrenched, so deeply present in the collective mindset.
Could you give some examples of how they have organized and or how some important historical precedents?
Yeah, there has been, the emergency of so many online communities that foster, for example, the value of the natural Afro hairstyle, because Afro hair is a visible racial marker that for many, many decades, it has been associated with a lot of negative attributes. So there has been a lot of movements challenging this and praising the natural Afro hairstyle, not only as an aesthetic choice, but mainly as a political positioning against enduring racism in Brazil. So that's one example. Another example that's very powerful regards sharing lived experience of racism by Black people, mainly Black women, with the objective to empower them to tell, look, you're not alone. We understand what you feel. We understand what you're going through. And that helps them to process those lived experience of racism and challenging them. So those are some, examples of those initiatives that have been gaining ground in the past few years.
Yeah. And so you point out that the expansion of social media has resulted in an increase of hate speech, quite the opposite of what platforms like Facebook promised when they started. And at the same time, the same platforms have also been used to create wider organized movements and different forms of activism. So how do you explain these different results? What is going on here? What's the relation between social media and hate speech?
Yeah, in fact, we have to step back a bit. So I talk about the resistance initiatives, but first I should talk about the hate speech on social media. Because since the mid-2000s, when those major social media platforms, they emerged, you know, Facebook, Twitter, and WhatsApp, and Instagram, and so forth, they have enabled those people that praise white supremacy to convey their racist, their discriminatory ideologies on social media, and also to engage other like-minded people to amplify their voices in the online environment. So this has become a breeding ground to disseminate those discriminatory ideologies. We are talking here about racism against Black people, and especially Black women, but it's not only that. There's also misogyny, homophobia, and xenophobia, and all sorts of hate speech. And social media has empowered, in the negative sense, those people, because with these networking capabilities, they are able to connect with like-minded people and amplify their voices in ways that you would not see in the offline context, you know?
And you also talk quite a bit about the failure of legal responses to racism in this kind of platforms. Could you say something about that?
Yes, absolutely. So what happens is that racism is a crime in Brazil. It's foreseen in the legislation. However, I'm not a legal expert, but I have read a bit about that too. Also to write in the book, there are two streams, let's put it this way. So first is what they call racial injury, when you offend someone, an individual person. And the other is the crime of racism, when there is flagrant, blatant discrimination against a group of people. But the sanctions are completely different. So for racial injury, the legislation says that the person, if convicted, can face up to 6 months incarceration. And oftentimes the judge has the power to change that penalty instead of incarceration as a social sanction, for example, to purchase food for people in need, you know, for a charity, a donation for a charity, something like that. And the other crime, that crime of racism, that is more difficult also to prove. So the legislation says that it's up to 5 years incarceration. However, most cases of racist discourses online, on social media, on the internet in general, they are classified as racial injury. And as I said, the sanction is up to 6 months incarceration. That never happens. It's always converted through social benefits, like donating for a charity. So that creates in the population the perception of impunity, because people say, okay, that the person has engaged in a hate speech on social media, but the penalty is so light that it looks like nothing happened.
And that, in the case that this kind of speech is detected, because another thing that you talked about is how there's a shared responsibility shared between the company, say Facebook, and the users in trying to report and monitor this kind of speech, and how, and you mentioned how Facebook is lacks the resources actually to do a good monitoring.
Yes, absolutely, because those large corporations, they have those powerful algorithms, but they are not enough to capture all hateful content that circulates on social media. And they also have moderators. I will not remember the exact number now, but I think that's something like 6,000, 7,000 people that Facebook employs only as moderators of content. But those people, 6,000 or 7,000, now I don't have the exact number on the top of my head, but they are to deal with all the language that Facebook deals with. So it's practically impossible, you know. So they also rely on the users to flag some content that is considered disturbing. But the response time of those platforms usually is not as fast as people would like to, so that the content it circulates on social media for a long time. And you know that also usually the users, they don't have an account in just one social media platform. Oftentimes they have accounts across a variety of social media platforms. So it means that a disturbing content or a hateful discourse that has been published in one social media platform, it can easily circulate across many others. And the effect of this is the amplification of the negative impact on the life of the person that has been targeted in that hate speech.
So in this book, you were mentioning different social media platforms, but here you focus mainly on Facebook and Facebook data. I think you need to correct me here, but that Brazil is kind of like the third or fourth most important market for Facebook. And I was wondering if you could talk about a little bit about your process of collecting this data, what methodology you used, and yes, why you chose Facebook primarily.
Yes, in fact. I collected Facebook data first because those data were publicly available. So I worked only with content that was open and also to safeguard people's privacy. And I focus on Facebook in particular, first because the largest social media platform in the world. And second, because it's extremely popular in Brazil. Brazil is the third largest market for this specific social media platform. Although the dynamic regarding the dissemination of hate speech, it's the same across different social media platforms. So I have examined, in fact, more than 200 different social media Facebook communities. But the way those discourses are disseminated on Facebook, in a sense, is not that different from what you would find on Twitter or Instagram, for example.
And so what did you find? Who are these jokers? Who are the main targets of racist jokes?
Yes, there are three main aspects that I found when examining those data. First is that the predominant profile of the people who engage in the practice of hate speech in Brazil are men on their early 20s. So that is the first aspect. The second aspect is that their target are mostly Black women, aged between 20 to 35 years old, and upward mobile Black women. So that's the second aspect. And the third, that's even more alarming, is the fact that those hate discourses, those racist discourses fostered on social media, they keep engaging new and recurrent users for up to 3 years after the original publication. So if an individual posts hateful content today, that same content is capable of keeping engaging new people to the same conversation for 2 years from now. So that is very alarming because it means that it amplifies the negative impacts on the life of the person that has been targeted by that hateful post. Do you understand?
Right. And I guess the only way to counter that would be to take down that content so that its life is not that long, right?
Yeah, in fact, that's why the society demands from those large corporations to be faster in removing those disturbing content.
And so what do these jokers, as you call them, try to do? Have you found any obsessions, recurrent themes? What are some of the most prevalent things they are reacting to?
Yes, in fact, so that's why in my book, I started explaining or reviewing the history of colonialism and its legacy, and especially the whitening ideology and racial democracy, because those ideologies, those constructs, they are present up to nowadays, up to the current time. And you can see them manifested on hate speech on social media. So to be more clear on this aspect, so the racist discourse that I have examined on social media, they can either be explicitly or disguised in jokes. But in a sense, what they are doing is to challenge the upward social mobility of Black people, especially Black women, in a way to delegitimize their position of, how can I say, a position of, not a privilege, that's not the right word that I'm looking for, but what they are trying to say is that you don't belong in this position. Your position is subservient, is at the bottom of the pyramid. So to give an example, there was one post that I can analyze it, where the user said, in regards to a black woman who had been on vacation in Europe, and then this post said, the place of black women is not on Europe traveling, but in the kitchen. So it's a way to convey the idea of her social position, her legitimate social position, is not in the whitening space, but rather in the kitchen, in the back of the social class. I don't know if it was clear for you.
Yes, yes. And so why do you think Black women have been more targeted than Black men, for instance?
Yes, because it's another legacy of the colonialism in Brazil, because the Black women, they were the, how can I say, they were subject to a variety of humiliations. So they worked in the house, you know, as in the big house. They worked also in the farms, and they were abused by the settlers. So this has been going on for so many centuries, and it has become naturalized as her position or their position is at the bottom of the pyramid. So that is so deeply, you know, linked to the collective mindset that people think that's natural, that's normal to belittle Black women this way on social media.
And so what's the importance or what is revealing about them using primarily jokes instead of direct racist discourse?
Yeah, the fact is that since jokes, they are a socially accepted form of communication, they become very convenient for white supremacists to convey the ideologies without sounding completely explicitly racist. And so they can also transfer the responsibility to the object of the mockery, because the person that is the object of the mockery, the subject of the mockery, becomes powerless, because if he or she complains, it's considered, okay, you cannot take a joke, it's just harmless joke. But in fact, it's not harmless, because deep in there, there is so much ideologies that position those Black people in position of inferiority, you know. So that's why humor or race joke has become so convenient for those people.
Right. And I guess they can also appeal to arguments of freedom of speech, right? To defend the kind of things they're saying.
Yeah, in a way, yes. It also, they claim freedom of speech. But the fact is that those racist jokes, they become so naturalized in the social fabric that even children, they learn them and they replicate them. So it passed from one generation to another. And that becomes, you know, part of the social fabric. So that's the problem with the race joke, because it's difficult to challenge, because they claim that it's harmless, but it's not harmless. And also the fact that it perpetuates and it's passed from one generation to another.
And have you found major differences between the online and offline racism? Do you see the same? So jokes are the same in one?
No, the jokes are exactly the same. Of course, that offline, not all social circumstances, people can recite them. And so you, in the offline context, usually people need, a degree of proximity with the subject of the joke. So it's very difficult in the offline context. People tell or recite a joke against someone that he or she doesn't know in real life. On the other hand, online, in the online environment, especially on social media, they disregard those, I call social distance, in the fact that this proximity between one object and the other. So, for example, celebrities, you know, people that are on the media more frequently, they are easily targeted because in the online environment, the white supremacists, they think, okay, that the person is famous. So it's like I know her intimately. So they don't, they're not restrained by any limit. They just recite, you know, their hate against that people, even though they have no personal relationship.
And you also mentioned that in spite of them defending the idea that jokes are innocent, they still are very, they want to remain anonymous, and that you even try to have like direct contact with certain individuals, but they weren't open to this kind of personal dialogue. Could you talk more about the power of anonymity in encouraging these attitudes?
People who engage in these practices online, they believe that the computer screen protects them, you know? So there is this belief that, okay, I'm behind the computer screen, so I can write anything that I want without any restriction, and I will not be found. But that is completely false, because technology evolves every day, and it's completely possible to identify the people if it's needed. So there are means to identify those people who engage in this practice. So that's the first thing. The second aspect that is even more revealing is that in most of the cases that I have analyzed, so the people who engage in this practice, you know, white supremacy and hate speech and so forth, they feel very empowered when they are posting their content, they are attacking someone. However, the moment that that attack reaches the headlines of the news, it's captured, for example, it becomes a topic that discussed in the newspapers, in a magazine, or a TV program, etc., you know what these people do? They take one of the four actions. First, they, or not in, exactly in this order, you know, but they can delete the post, they can delete or cancel their account on social media, they change the status of the account from public to private, or they claimed that was only a joke. So what does it mean? It means that before that attack became object of a news article, they felt very very empowered. The moment that a specific attack was the subject of a news article, and so the spotlight was thrown in his direction, so he becomes scared and says, okay, I have to do something. So either I try to eliminate any trace of my manifestation, or I claim I was on a joke. I didn't mean to hurt anyone.
And so what has been the response of the online community in general beyond these groups? What forms of anti-racist strategies have you found?
Yeah, that is interesting because although the attacks, they can be very aggressive in the language that they use, because as I said before, those racist discourse on social media, they can be explicitly or they can also be disguised in jokes. Of course, that when they're disguised in jokes, the language usually is not very aggressive because it's meant to be funny. And when they are explicitly, they can be aggressive or not aggressive in terms of language. But regarding the resistance initiative that have been fostered by Black Brazilians and especially Black women, they don't challenge those attacks using the same level of vocabulary that they use, you know, the white supremacists. On the opposite, as I said before, so those communities, they try to empower Black people by fostering the political symbology of the Afro hairstyle, natural hairstyle, you know, to claim a renewed perception of Blackness. So they go in a different direction to challenge those discourses. So instead of fighting fire with fire, you know, they adopt a different approach to challenge those negative perceptions regarding Blackness.
The book was published a year ago, and you were able to comment on Jair Bolsonaro's campaign with his slogan, Brazil is my color, and a little bit about his first year in the presidency. I was wondering, how do you see the situation now? Have the same trends continued? Has the pandemic changed anything?
No, unfortunately, the situation has worsened. First, of course, for the pandemic, but also because this presidency is very negationist in all aspects, and also not only regarding the pandemic, but also regarding racism. They deny that racism exists. They say both the president and the vice president, in more than one occasion, they have said racism doesn't exist in Brazil. It's something that has been created by foreigners that are trying to export this ideology to Brazil. So they rewrite history, you know. So that is very bad because and problematic because that challenges so many progress that the Black organized movement has achieved over the past few decades. So the situation is very complicated. And the fact, and given the fact that he and the vice president, they represent the most important public figure in the country, you know, official public figure. So they represent the voice of the Brazilian state. So that is very problematic when a figure in his position comes publicly to say, know, this kind of thing, that racism does not exist, you know. So it's again, is the confirmation, is the reinforcement of the same beliefs that we talked regarding the construction of the modern Brazil based on whitening ideology and racial democracy. So it's just the perpetuation of the same ideology that has been around for almost two centuries.
Just to finish the interview, I wanted to know what you were working on right now, if you could share that with us.
Oh, yes, absolutely. So thank you very much for the interview. and the invitation. So nowadays I'm working on two major projects. First is a book chapter to be published next year, where I address the political symbology of a female Afro hairstyle in Brazil. So this political symbology behind the Afro hairstyle. And the second project, I have been working with Brazil's largest anti-racist online platform. It's called Feminismos Plurais, or Plural Feminism. So I've been working on a couple of projects with them regarding publications and online teaching. So those are the two main projects I'm working at the moment.
Wow, and we look forward to reading them. Thank you so much for being here with us today and for talking about your research, and we hope to have you again soon.
Thank you very much.